All right, welcome everyone to the Planning Commission workshop for Thursday, January 4th, 2024, 4 p.m. I call this meeting to order. First item of business is determination of a quorum. We have 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. So we do indeed have a quorum. Adoption of the agenda. Do I hear a motion to adopt this evening's agenda?
I move that we adopt this evening's agenda.
Do I hear a second?
I second that.
All those in favor, say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Motion passes. Visitor communication. This is the time provided for individuals wishing to address the Planning Commission regarding issues not already on the agenda. Do we have anyone here in the audience that would like to discuss anything that's not on this evening's agenda? Okay. And do we have anyone on Zoom that would like to participate?
None.
Okay, thank you. Before we jump into the work session, I'd like to recognize the newest member of the commission, Rick Retzman. Welcome.
Thank you.
Glad to have you here.
New kid on the block, so I'm gonna plead ignorance for quite a while here.
Oh, it can last for a lot longer.
Well, whoever is before me, your time is up. Okay, well, no excuses now.
So we'll go ahead and with that, jump right into the work session, and I'll turn it over to staff.
Thank you, Chair Seymour. Good evening, commissioners, those in attendance tonight. Matthew Martin, City of Sisters Community Development Department. We are here to begin a conversation about wildfire mitigation through development code, municipal code standards to address those impacts or mitigate those impacts associated with wildfire and the threat that we know is ever present in our community and surrounding areas. And we come before you not only knowing that there's that impending natural threat that's on the horizon or in the region, but City Council has identified this as a primary goal to accomplish in this fiscal year 23-24. And as they stated it, we'll work towards updating defensible space structural hardening requirements through the development code. But do want to acknowledge that the development code is just one piece of how the city can regulate and manage defensible space and building hardening within the city. And we'll be looking to potential amendments to the municipal code, but also recognizing the partnerships that we have in the region with our sisters Camp Sherman Fire District, our land managers, particularly the public entities, the Oregon Department of Forestry, U.S. Forest Service, that there's a collaborative effort among those managing agencies or service providers to address these potential risks and minimize and or mitigate the effects of a wildfire if it moves into our region. Please, and throughout. Yeah, so go ahead.
So when we're talking about this, is this for new construction only, or are we thinking about retroactive modifications of existing structures?
I think all of that is on the table with regard to vegetation management in particular. But I think with the development code, primarily we're looking at new development as it comes to new structures and new landscape plans, for example. But at the same rate, we do recognize that there are hazards associated with overgrown vegetation or poorly managed properties. And so we have a mechanism in there in our municipal code to address that either through nuisance. For example, we already have standards in the municipal code for nuisance vegetation, overgrown grasses or weeds that
but
pose that risk.
If somebody has a shake roof, for example, you're going to go and maybe do some education. Is that the idea?
So that's one of the other components of that is critical to all of this is education. So to understand the importance of it and that ongoing maintenance of properties, structures, as well as vegetation. So I think it's multifaceted. But when it comes to structures, I don't think we have a legal authority, frankly, to go back and say you shall modify your structure. But there may be opportunities to through that education, and if there's other grant opportunities that are certainly available from other entities to improve those structures. But Yeah, that's an excellent question.
Would that also be during structure modification? Example, if you replace more than 30% of the roof and it was shake, you know, no longer that kind of thing?
Exactly. Yeah. So if you do have a substantial change to a development, either through addition to a structure or new structures on a property, those are opportunities. If you have that particular defined threshold, to then you shall, change the, again, shake roofs are one good example. That you shall modify the entire structure or entire roof. Excellent. Keep those questions coming. This is intended to be that introductory effort to kind of get your a foundation of understanding of what defensible space, what building hardening is, so that when and if we embark on actual amendments to the codes, you have that foundational and background knowledge on what we're talking about. And so the goal of tonight is to provide that understanding of what defensible space and building or structural hardening is, and give you a bit of an overview of what existing standards are in the in the Sisters Development Code and Municipal Code. Other standards that are have been adopted or forthcoming on a statewide scale, and then highlighting some other examples that have been implemented in the state that we can look to as guidance, as best practices to consider in adopting here locally. And then discuss next steps, recommendations, priorities, ideas that the Planning Commission would like to consider. So with that, I think we'll dive right in. So we're talking about defensible space. That's establishing, maintaining vegetation in the concentric areas around structures and human development. Those are your buildings, other improvements to a property. The idea is that as you are in closer proximity to a structure or improvement, that the vegetation is limited, non-existent, or well-spaced. And then as you get farther out, that your tree spacing is not as critical, that vegetation management is not as critical as you get farther away. So what it is providing that that defense in the structures or around the structure. So this isn't fighting the fire. It's in the event that the fire is moves into the area, that you're providing that protective buffer around a structure. So what one example that we've looked to or I've identified of one of many expert organizations that put out there is the NFPA, the National Fire Protection Association, as one guide, recognizing again that there's other recommendations that we can look to. But the idea, what they've identified is the immediate, intermediate, and extended areas. So within that immediate area, that 0 to 5 feet from the structure or the improvement, we're looking for no combustible materials. That's removing any bark mulch or other drier or flammable materials within that immediate area, so that you don't have that opportunity for fire ignition or spread right up against the structure. Again, what we need to remember is that this is establishing those areas, but also maintaining them, because over time, or clearly, trees and vegetation have that habit of growing and sloughing off and dying and needing that maintenance going on.
Dropping pine
needles. You got it. So it's ongoing. So you may have a new development or gone through and made an effort to make a perfect defensible space. Well, that's going to be compromised all but immediately and begin to overgrow. The next is the intermediate area. That'd be from that 5 foot out to approximately 30 feet, where we're beginning to see spacing amongst trees or crowns of clusters of trees to provide that that separation, that we don't get a crown fire jumping from crown to crown. Then you're into the immediate area, and then you have close proximity to the structures themselves. So what we're within that area, we're thinking about, well, let's just describe these particular areas and then give you another visual. And then beyond there is the extended area. That's so what's identified here is 30 to 100 feet, recognizing that suburban urban lots may not be 100 feet wide in many aspects, and what our standards are 40 feet width for new lots. One example is that you may not have that authority to go across the property line to maintain your neighbor's vegetation. So these are just kind of the recommendations, hoping that there's a collective effort amongst property owners to maintain the these defensible spaces. But as long as you are looking at your areas of influence, your private property, then you're in better shape within those areas.
Well, and Matt, I was looking at it under this view, I was thinking that if the urban growth boundary expands, the lots may get bigger. I mean, like farther out. So it's something more to consider for going forward, wouldn't it be?
Well, and in those larger areas, so if we, with an urban growth boundary expansion, you may have like a 10-acre block, for example, that we'd have a master plan coming in that may have actually have smaller lots, that those 4,000 square foot lots, for example. But as a master plan, we'd be looking at it as an entirety, one defensible space plan amongst the entire development. So
I was thinking as much about having even, you know, 2-acre lots.
So we don't have a 2-acre lot standard.
That's not allowed.
Not an option. So we're going okay. Beyond that. And have,
thank you
and
for telling me that.
Have maximum lot sizes for.
Are you talking about like while it's still in the county or after it's been annexed?
After it's been annexed.
Okay.
So how does that work? I actually didn't know there were lot maximums.
Scott, could you turn your mic on? Thank you.
Yeah, so the concept is not that we have the larger lotting patterns on the fringe of town, but those annexation areas will be ripe for establishing and getting to that density to get those units that we need. So, you know.
Is there something in the code I can read?
Yeah, so that? We can point you to that.
Yeah, that'd be
so,
helpful.
For example, in our residential or district or multifamily residential district, we have established minimum and maximum lot sizes.
I guess I hadn't noticed that.
And that's what we'd be looking for. So I, you know, a 2-acre per lot development would not get to those densities that are also required in those zones. So
I definitely understand that that wouldn't be accomplishing the goal, but I didn't know that it was written into code. So that's very helpful. Thank you. Okay.
So when we get into the vegetation management, again, we're talking about the spacing between these built environments and the trees, as well as managing those ladder fuels or underbrush that are below those tree canopies so that we avoid spread of a ground fire that then through those ladders climb up into the tree canopy and then jump from canopy to canopy. That's where you really get spread from tree to tree to structure and so on. Of course, there are other fire behaviors such as ember drift or ember storms where it's not an actual fire that's in proximity to the structure. That's the risk, but it's those ember drifts that can drift upwards of a mile or multiple miles, and it just takes one spark, as they say. I'll pause there for a moment, and I did want to acknowledge not only Scott Woodford joining me here at the desk, but Chief Johnson with the Sisters Camp Sherman Fire District was scheduled to join us this evening, but he sends his regrets. He's not feeling good this evening, so he took this day off. He did join me at the City Council work session, but has been intimately involved in our efforts to date and will certainly be involved moving forward.
We kind of went over some of this before when we had a couple guests in as well.
Yeah, so this is a bit of a review or a ramp up from it was in May when we is Wildfire Awareness Month, and so this was a chance to kind of provide some of this introduction. So you have the perhaps we're repeating some of these things, but we're starting to get into drilling down to the standards. So this is just a visual example of kind of one where the state's going with their defensible space standards is 10 feet of separation from structures, chimneys, other man-made environments, meaning that if it's not the house, you may have a wooden deck or a fence that extends from the structure. That 10 feet is measured from the extent of the structure, that deck, or any fencing in proximity to the building itself.
Hey, Matt.
Yeah.
What about like where a fence you know, a lot of people fence and connect to their house. That's bad.
That, yeah, not the fire expert, but I'll say just in short, yeah, that's bad. The experts that I have consulted, they describe that as a wick leading the fire to the structure. So if you have a fence extending, you know, in some distance from your house, but it's within that 5-foot zone, it could run along that fence and right up into your structure. So one, jumping a little bit ahead, but one strategy that Ashland has employed is requiring metal gates or non-combustible gates in that proximity to the house. So you have a gate separation of, say, 5 feet. Then you have your wood fence beyond that. Hmm. So this graphic shows individual trees, but there's the idea and the notion that clusters of trees are okay. So we're not creating a moonscape or just individual spikes along the horizon, but rather you can, depending on the property and the arrangement, you can have individual trees or clusters of trees that are close proximity, but then you have that 10-foot separation from that cluster, again, to avoid that jump from the cluster to another tree and so on. And then what's identified as the 6-foot or 1/3 rule, that's the limbing up of those ladder fuels. And that's any grasses, dead vegetation, needles, branches that have gathered on the ground. You need to be clearing that out from underneath the drip line of the tree, but also reducing that vegetation down. With grasses, our standard and the kind of the industry best practice is 4 inches for grasses. But also recognizing that you may have other vegetation, shrubbery that would be taller than 4 inches, and that's okay. Recognizing what the condition of the vegetation is it green, in good health, or better yet, a fire resistant species.
So technically, if you have a lot of bushes around your house that are closer than 5 feet, you should be taking them all out.
Should be thinking about that, removing those or moving them farther out from the 5 feet. Which is contrary to a lot of what we've done through decades.
Oh yeah.
So here's where we go back. We have
mulch and bushes all the way around.
That's right. And arborvitae, high oil content, that were those the landscape right up against the house. The bark mulch, the cedar siding, the cedar shake roofs. Oh, yeah. This is
vertical that, cedar siding.
A lot of this was mandated, you know, through design standards within subdivisions. So the changing of climate conditions, changing of understanding, we have to change what we do if we want to reduce those impacts. And frankly, I'm guilty of going against many of these practices that I've learned and am working on. So every little bit, it helps. That was the quick overview of defensible space and what we're talking about with spacing, vegetation management, reducing those ladder fuels to reduce the run of a ground fire or reduce the potential for a crown fire that then gets in close proximity to a structure, ignites the structure itself, and then we get into a property loss and potential risk to people. Any questions there?
I got a letter from my insurance company saying that they reserve the right to come onto the property and modify vegetation and everything to reduce the risk of fire.
Interesting.
That would be weird, having them wander in. And
yeah, it was like, okay.
Give them advance notice.
Yeah. This was a year ago, and they haven't done anything since, but it was strange to get that.
Some of that management can be done with fire resistant, nothing's fireproof, but fire resistant plants like rhododendrons, that kind of thing, which rhododendrons over here aren't really good, but there's fire resistant plants that can be used as well.
Yep.
OSU has a really nice list of those.
And we'll just touch on and provided some examples and resources, but jumping to that, the best practices that City of Ashland has employed, they've gone as far as not only defensible space, but prohibited species of trees and vegetation that are not allowed to be established to just to that point. So, we can certainly look to that as,
yeah, we get
as one of the many strategies.
Plants from fire, and then you got to worry about deer.
Right.
But it narrows it down.
Yeah, between drought tolerant and fire resistant and
right.
And deer resistance. Yeah, yeah.
Cut the trees.
Yep. So potential competing interests when we look to policies and development of standards. Okay. Jump into building hardening, structural hardening, home hardening. The idea is that that you're putting up a resistance against the potential of a structure igniting, and that comes in from building materials that may be fire resistant or reducing the risk of intrusions of embers or other drift that can intrude or go within or above below the structure and then ignite it. So there's different strategies, different priorities that can be employed. Again, above all of this is maintaining that structure, maintaining the property itself. So examples being maintaining a good roof in good condition, replacing damaged or lost shingles so that embers cannot settle on a roof and then hit the subroofing and then ignite it there. Maintaining gutters of any debris that can add up, not only creating the risk of kind of moisture issues, but also fire risks. And then where we're talking about maintaining vegetation or in proximity to the structure. But what you can do from a construction standpoint to work our way down from the top down of the structure, is fire resistant materials in the actual construction of the structure. And that'd be with composite asphalt shingles or metal roofing, as opposed to cedar shake roofing materials, as one example.
Is metal superior to asphalt for fire resistance? Do you know? Or
I can't say with 100% certainty from my understanding, but I believe it would be it's in the fire resistant category, but I don't know I'm not even going to guess, but I think it's hold up longer, and so it not deteriorate as quickly as an asphalt shingle, and therefore not require replacement or that risk of not maintaining it in good order, but still requires that diligence in maintaining it. Then ventilation, that either roof vents or soffit or eave vents, putting in appropriate screening to avoid or block any embers from drifting within that space, that attic area, resting within the flammable materials that may be up there, your insulation or other construction materials. And so the industry standard by code currently is 1/4 inch mesh within those areas. What's being recommended, and as the best practice, is 1/8 inch or greater in the screen material that'll capture any of those embers that may be drifting through the area. So that's in the roof vents or in the eaves. Then thinking about siding, that's going away from untreated cedar siding or other wood and into hardy plank or other concrete siding materials that are out there to reduce that risk, or metal to be more resistant. Windows, minimum of double pane windows, because under heat, of course, glass can break. If it's single pane, then you have you don't have that barrier that the window was providing to that fire intrusion. Two pane, dual pane, at least you can have one pane fail, but the other uphold and keep the fire out. Also thinking about vinyl windows or similar materials do have that risk of a failure through melting, and then you get gaps, embers can come through or flames, and then you've compromised the structure moving forward there.
Another good reason not to put vegetation underneath your windows.
Exactly. And so that's where we're getting to not only the structure in how it's constructed, but what we're doing around it. And acknowledging the attached fencing that's in within that immediate proximity to the structure adds that risk of being compromised and failure. I don't, at this point, admit to being any kind of building code expert, but because as you read into the draft building hardening standards that have been adopted or prepared by the State Building Codes Division, it really gets into the rating of materials, that fire resistance. So that's beyond my understanding, but I think it gets into those contractors and designers and builders, critical that they understand what those level of standard is. Any questions there? Okay. So what do we have now in place? We do have some form of defensible space standards. We call it an urban-rural interface. It doesn't use the terminology of defensible space or fire and fuel breaks that we are become most accustomed to these days. So that alone is one consideration for adopting or updating our code to better reflect what the terminology, the industry standards are. The idea here, but there are standards in place that could work to refining those. Noting that they're in the municipal code, so not subject to the development review process for new development, but rather applicable to all properties that are within the extreme fire risk category on the Oregon Department of Forestry map as of 2014. That 2014 map is out of date at this point, so that's another reason to be exploring updating our standards.
With our smaller lot size now for efficiency measures, I mean, houses are getting so close to each other. Is that a fire risk to have houses 5 feet away from each other? Or?
I think, yes, certainly. You know, so if the difference is, you know, structures being 100 feet, I mean, giving a kind of an extreme example, but
15 or 20 feet.
Away. Yeah. So the farther away, they're not going to ignite each other. But so certainly if there's, our setbacks haven't changed from property line, but if you're getting more structures in closer proximity to each other, that risk is higher. So there is that, that benefit of adopting these building hardening standards to reduce that fire ignition chance, and then that coupled with defensible space standards are our efforts to minimize that risk. So there's a trade-off in meeting these goals of providing housing units or density within a city, recognizing that there's an increased potential risk of fire hazard and property loss, but looking at these other strategies to as one part of the toolkit that we have in the area. But that's a reality. So just want to recognize that we do have codes in place. They're antiquated and need to warrant updating to address current best practices. But you'll find some similar standards from the setup, pre-spacing, the mowing of vegetation and vegetation management there. Also want to acknowledge in the municipal code is a roofing material standard that prohibits new shake roofs within the city limits. Actually, countywide, the new shake roofs are prohibited. So that's where we're looking for asphalt, slate, metal, or other fire-resistant roofing material. Built in there is a threshold of if you're building an addition or replacing a portion of a roof that if you meet that threshold, I believe it's 25 or 30%, then you're looking at replacing the entirety of the roof.
Hey, Matt.
Yes.
In thinking about you know, updating this code or anything. What does even, what is clear space, what does that mean? It's not a particularly well-defined.
That's right. And I think it's another reason to adopt kind of clearer language. Means an area under or adjacent to a tree that is free from ladder fuels. So it's not very descriptive in its term, but then you get drill down to the standard below. But it's really the idea of limbing up your trees and reducing or removing those ladder fuels. But yeah, that was one reason to quote clear space, that it is a identified term. So what's forthcoming? In the 2021 session, the state legislature and then ultimately the governor signed Senate Bill 762 that implemented and set the course for adopting a new statewide wildfire risk map and then directed the State Building Codes Division to adopt building hardening standards and the Oregon State Fire Marshal to adopt statewide defensible space standards. They have all drafted those standards, meaning the State Fire Marshal drafted defensible space standards that were included in your packet. And the Building Code Division has actually adopted and updated the R327 standards and implemented those that have already adopted those standards locally. And I say that because the trigger of implementing or those going live, both the defensible space building hardening, is the adoption of that wildfire risk map, which there was a rollout last summer that was met with some resistance that everybody seems to be aware of. And that was swiftly withdrawn for consideration and for set for refinement. And Oregon Department of Forestry is actively working on that, but there's no set issue date even for consideration of public comment and ultimately adoption. So that is an unknown. And
didn't council direct us to go ahead and move along with our plans even without the wildfire or the hazard map, because that's kind of sketchy. So why wait for them?
Yep. And so that, we'll talk about that a little bit later, but yeah, so that was that uncertainty and unknown on how much longer that may be drawn out, and an effort to adopt some local provisions, some local control had does have a, you know, specific term and, you know, connotation, but that we can influence where these standards are applied and not rely on that map and not rely on those particular standards. We do want to make sure that anything that is adopted here locally is at least the standards that are included in the State Fire Marshal's defensible space standards or the building code standards, because we can't be less restrictive than those, but we can certainly be more restrictive. But we want to make sure that we're tracking that so that we don't adopt something only to have to update it or be superseded by a statewide standard. And then thinking about best practices that are out there. Mentioned City of Ashland, Oregon, and Southern Oregon, another fire-prone and fire-risk area, as testament of the, I don't know the name of the fire, but that ran through Talent, which is just north of Ashland, that certainly, clearly, there's a fire risk there. City of Ashland has had these codes in practice and in place for some years now. But they have a relatively comprehensive and robust program that looks to not only community development, but the fire district to work in conjunction with one another to implement and educate on these standards. But it does apply to any new construction on individual lots, commercial properties, master plans on a broader scale, and looks to implementing these defensible space standards, landscaping material, the type of plants and location of plants on the property, fencing standards, among other, and these specific fire prevention and control plans that are looking at it on a subdivision or a master plan scale throughout that development. So we'll be looking to them as well as other jurisdictions for those best practices and see what we can employ here locally here in City of Sisters. Any questions there? Again, the idea is that we're not diving into the specific standards tonight or really scrutinizing them. I just wanted to kind of give you an idea of kind of the scope or the different strategies that are employed. I do want to note that, you know, we in community development and the Planning Commission, we have kind of one small aspect of addressing wildfire risks in the area. So again, noting that we need to be working with our partners that are land managers on the public side, our service providers, not only the fire district, but our electric companies, among others, and Schutz County and emergency management, that we're all kind of spokes within a larger wheel to address the risk of wildfire, the resiliency to wildfire, and the recovery from wildfire. What I offered in your packet, as well as City Council, were some options to consider. That being, monitor and wait for the state to adopt a wildfire risk map, of which, spoiler alert, the City Council is not in a position or have the further kind of interest in waiting to see where that yeah, lands. And again, some local control in where any standards are applied. Built into the R3-27 standards, building code standards, is a mechanism and a procedure for local adoption of the R3-27 codes. And that's one strategy to look forward to. In its entirety, you know, verbatim. Third option staff identified was to adopt the state fire marshal's defensible space standards as written. Option four, adopt alternatives, looking to those other jurisdictions or perhaps something more comprehensive or more detailed or restrictive than the state standards. And then the all-encompassing other. What else is out there is available as tools to address these issues?
I would think it would be hard to use a single state standard, one size fits all, because there are certain areas that are way more prone to wildfire risk than others. And unless the state took the worst case scenario and developed their standards from that, then it's not going to apply.
Yep, I believe you're spot on there. And plus, you're looking at many different jurisdictions with different risks, different political positions and policy positions that you have to have. If it's something's going to be applied statewide, it needs to be generally palatable to a wide cross action. So meaning that it may not be as detailed or robust as you may want here in a more fire prone area. So that's a great point. So the direction that staff heard from the council when we met late last year was don't wait for the adoption of the wildfire risk map. Move ahead and begin to explore adoption of standards here for City of Sisters. Also, pursue the local adoption of the R327 building hardening standards. That not only applies to the structures. Let me get back to that one. I've had a profound moment or comment I wanted to offer, but we'll get back to that. Excuse me for that. And then look to adopt and develop local defensible space standards. So they found that the statewide defensible state standards were perhaps a little watered down and not specific to the conditions that we have here in the City of Sisters, and therefore look to not only the statewide defensible space standards as a guide, but City of Ashland and other communities that have adopted similar standards as a guide. That is going to probably be a pretty robust and multi-meeting, multi-step process to address each one of those components. And where I kind of got locked up was that the council's recognized that the R327 building hardening standards are pretty much fully baked and ready for adoption. I don't think there's going to be a lot of consideration of changes that we may need to make for City of Sisters proper. And with that, that may be on a more fast track than the defensible space standards. And so decoupling defensible space from building hardening and moving forward perhaps more quickly with the building hardening, because that's a chance to get ahead of any new construction that may be coming in individual structures, whereas the defensible space can follow that and be applicable to new site subdivision
projects that we have going now. It's too late to apply any of these standards to the approved projects, right?
Correct. Yeah, that any building code standards, any you know, more detailed landscape material type of defensible space criteria would not apply. But with that said, there are those opportunities to implement the vegetation management side of things, from removing vegetation, mowing it down, limbing trees up to reduce those risks, those nuisances that are created
right.
by them.
We've just approved some pretty big subdivisions.
Right. So the quick answer is no, we can't look back at those and retroactively apply any of these spacing or material standards. But
isn't ORSC 327, that's building codes, state building codes. So anybody building today should be following minimum state building codes in addition to local code. Is that correct?
But if they started before this was enacted, then
when was RSC or the R327 actually?
Well, to trigger, it's in place now, and it's been in place for some time and just updated it this last year. But those building hardening standards only apply to the high risk and extreme areas or those jurisdictions that have adopted the code already. So we haven't locally adopted any of those provisions except for that roofing material standard. So we can't impose these standards today. But if we were to get ahead and adopt the R327 within the next month or couple of months, then any new construction in those subdivisions would be subject to that building hardening.
Okay. Has anybody done any cost analysis for, you know, how much is that going to increase the cost of housing?
There, we can add that to part of this analysis as we get into more detail. But others, yes, Headwaters Economics has done an analysis. And there's two answers to that I'd like to offer is that most folks today do employ many of these strategies for building hardening because they recognize there's a value both in the longevity of the materials and that there's a value in investing in above the minimum standard that applies to. So you see a lot of applications of hardy plank siding of the asphalt composition roofs so you're already ahead. Yeah. than the minimum, because there are arguments that these standards will increase the cost of construction, and there is some legitimacy to that, but that study from Headwaters actually said that it's a nominal difference when you employ these building hardening standards, because you get to I think it may be looking at perhaps extreme examples, but cedar siding, for example, on a higher end home may be utilized at a higher cost, where hardy plank is at a better value than that type of building material. So you're getting into trade-offs there.
Plus, maybe the insurance companies eventually will establish a better rate for houses that are built to that standard and you would save over life of your policy or whatever.
Yeah, so I think
that's not the builder, that's the homeowner. So,
well, I think that that's one benefit that we're going to be exploring, that that the fire district is well aware of, that the council is aware of, is that, you know, we have heard, you know, at least anecdotally, that you know, premiums are going up, and perhaps coverage is being lost for a variety of reasons. There could be a strong argument that if we've employed and adopted these standards within the city limits, that we are at a lower risk to the impacts and property loss associated with wildfire, that that could be a argument to them, the insurance providers, that
I know that some insurance companies give you a discount if you have been FireWise certified.
Right, your community.
Too. Your community, or you can do individual buildings or a community, but yeah, that could affect, it depends on your insurance company, but that could affect your rates.
And FireWise is a program of, with added kind of neighborhood scale, just for those that are not aware, that you work to maintain and manage vegetation within a subdivision, evacuation routes, and other strategies to educate on wildfire risks, adopt and implement mitigation strategies, and continue kind of an outreach effort, and maintaining that certification kind of as a looks good to the neighborhood, and in some instances, some providers provides a financial benefit as well. And that could be one of those strategies we look towards. Don't want to go as far as requiring through our code provisions, but something similar.
Matt, what about what could potentially be the impact on the sale of a property if that sale goes through and we have a new code? Will that seller be required to bring that property up to the current code, such as like how we have to do with like wood stoves now and other items? How are we treating that?
It's a good question. That'll be part of our analysis.
Has the state given any guidance on that?
Not at this point. I'm kind of putting those pieces together, and what we are often in our world, we worry about takings of property rights or retroactively applying standards that weren't in place when the property was developed. So there's that potential legal risk of requiring it upon sale. I don't know how we get that mechanism into a development code.
I could imagine, you know, you'd have to tear all the siding off your house.
A new roof?
Or a roof, yeah, before you sell it, you know.
But I'm glad you raised it. It's a great example with the wood stoves, and kind of that's a great example to explore, is how was that established and then implemented through the sale of properties. So we'll certainly definitely make note of that.
And you said it was Headwaters. Is that like a agency or a organization that explores building costs when you have
a variety of economic analyses? Yeah, we certainly can push that out to the planning commission to understand that. But okay. Definitely something we want to consider with any development code standard, what those economic implications are. You know, pros and cons of it. That's been raised throughout the conversation we've been having at City Council amongst our partner agencies, on kind of making sure that we don't create an undue burden or issue with the best of intentions.
And just to add and build onto that, it's our intention to make sure that COBA is aware of these potential changes so that they aren't caught surprised at the end of the process. So that's one thing. At some point, we will be getting them engaged to make sure that they're aware of it.
Has there been any discussion about some sort of funding for people that existing places for people that want to get more in a line?
That's certainly one of those other tools that are in the toolbox to consider. If it's at a city level, that'd be a decision by city council to offer up any kind of grant or other loan programs.
Had they talked about it? Did city council bring it up? Or
I don't know that they specifically referenced it at our, I don't recall, at our work session. But in various conversations on different programs are looking for ways to, if we adopt any code standards, if it's the dark skies standards or others, that's just one example, is that if we're going to impose this this standard, especially there, and I look to you because you worked on it, that is retroactively. And so some incentive, some support to comply with the standards.
We have a bunch of buildings along Cascade that are like tinder boxes that are all wood, you know, wood siding that go with the Western theme, but
yep.
Burn pretty
bad. I could see, like, it's almost, it's ironic, like, if the state keeps dragging its feet on this wildfire map and you have places like Tollgate or Crossroads that don't have a label at all for extreme or high risk. But then we create this mandate for the city where we actually have access to more fire protection resources than they would out in, you know, it's like people are less protected in the area where they need it the most.
Yeah.
In terms of the policies that we implement. So I don't know. It's a bummer that the state's taking so long to.
I know there are grants available for communities to help with, you know, like vegetation management. I know the Black Butte Ranch last year or the year before got a pretty good sized grant for vegetation management. So there are stuff out there.
There's also a lot of money available through the Department of Agriculture for fire mitigation. Like my father, he lives up near Hood River. I think they gave him $25,000 for tree mitigation and brush removal and everything, but there's some, as with everything, there's some strict requirements, and it's geared more towards rural parcels. So I think it's like 5+ acres. So when it comes to smaller neighborhoods within city limits, because I checked for my lots in town and found that there was virtually no funding available, at least from the state or from the federal government, because the lots are too small.
But maybe that changes. Yeah. So different programs. So to answer your question, Commissioner Converse, that from the Vice Chair Converse, federal, state, nonprofit, local. I mean, Deschutes County has grant programs, but it does come down to the criteria that are applicable. If it's on individual property scale, size of property or neighborhood, what programs you already have in place, you know, so some are only available to those with the FireWise designation. But if we adopt these standards that require some level of improvements, that might create a pathway or open a door to some funding mechanisms. So we're always have our eyes on that, not only here, but again, with all our partner agencies.
Maybe we'll be the first fire safe city in Oregon or something like that. Well, actually, Ashland's probably there, you know, tree city, fire safe city or something.
We would have to redo a lot of buildings there.
Seems like a contradiction.
And so just one last note is that the city council was clear they would like to explore or look for these standards to apply citywide and not be associated with any risk categories or risk mapping. It just felt equitable and appropriate to be looking at all properties within the city limits as being a subject to these standards instead of potential pockets or a controversy from one lot to the other.
You know, Jeremy, on the other, if state drags their feet, maybe Deschutes County would decide that to come up with their own standards for that rather than the state, because the state could take forever.
Yeah, it probably comes down to like what people can afford too. And Deschutes County isn't going to be able to subsidize anything like what the state can, which can't subsidize what the federal government could. If we can get the federal government to, you know, like I would imagine they do in big flood zones in the Southeast, like, hey, we're at risk of burning down here. How about some federal money to harden Tollgate and Crossroads where they're right on the cutting edge of it? If that stuff burns and gets into the city, I mean, that's kind of like our first line of defense.
I think Tollgate is actually a Firewise community.
Are they?
Yeah, so this chance to promote some of our partners, or one in particular, is Project Wildfire, that is they're tasked with educating and employing programs to inform residents and provide mechanisms to address the risks of wildfire. So they're one of those partners that have funding available to go into some of these neighborhoods and have. I think it's Tollgate that has a kind of a community cleanup events in particular, where they come out and as a community, you have that collective resources to hire, if it's contractors or to rent the equipment for chippers and dumpster rentals, et cetera, and get out there and clean up as a group.
Yeah, I know, like where we are, they just rented a man lift and went around and trimmed all the bottoms of trees through the whole area.
Yeah, and sometimes it takes that that community aspect and to galvanize and get some work done, regardless of state action or mandated action.
And just like with the dark skies thing, where we kind of educate the community about why this is a good thing, it seems like a similar kind of action, community action, could be helpful. Even if it's not a bunch of money to help people, it's at least like, hey, what you can do on your little microcosm would be helpful.
Yeah, and a chance to promote, again, the Sisters Camp Sherman Fire District has their fire corps, is another example of volunteered, trained volunteers that you can call them up and have a individual property assessment that's available, and they'll go out and give you some recommendations on what you could do to make your property a bit more defensible and make those improvements. So do want to acknowledge that we're again just one spoke in the wheel as to mitigate those impacts of wildfire, and a lot of people thinking about this, a lot of people working on it from different perspectives. So that's the extent of my comments I have for you tonight. The questions and comments have been great throughout, but any other specific strategies that you're thinking about at this point, or direction that we should be considering as we work our way back? Our next steps will be to circle back with the city council and kind of report back what we know and what we discussed here tonight, and get some more kind of defined direction on what aspects of the code provisions we should be changing. Then we're back to you guys for actual development of those standards.
Do you want some input on what we think about those four options or five options?
Yes, absolutely.
Option four.
What is four? Very good.
That's my vote.
But we may want to also look at some of the wording too, where they use the urban rural, we're really an urban wildland. I mean, it makes a difference when you put that on there, that wildland thing kind of, we're a little bit unique here as opposed to like over in the valley.
Yeah, understood.
That's why I said option four, because it says, to go beyond what they have. So yeah. I was thinking the same thing, just to customize it, but to use it as a base.
Yeah. And what we'll be doing there is kind of providing those, different categories of strategies and what others have employed, and we can scrutinize those and see what's appropriate here in Sisters. Good. I guess if we're thinking about these, what I'm kind of hearing or implying is that you're wanting to move forward prior to adoption of the statewide map to explore these changes.
Mm-hmm.
Consistent with the city council.
Well, if it's going to be citywide anyway, it doesn't seem like it would be as dependent.
Exactly. Yeah. And really any weighting would be, it'd be that, that mechanism that once the map's adopted, then these standards would be in play. And so you're staying ahead of that, any of that trigger point.
Is this something that we need to vote on? You know, is this an actionable item here?
No.
This is a work session, right?
Yeah. Good question. Yeah. Just looking for that, informal feedback on kind of what we should be considering and reporting back to City Council.
And make us sit up there.
Yeah.
When we do the votes.
And our votes don't really.
Because they can throw them out at the end anyways.
Well, great. Thank you. Absent anything else?
Don't worry, I'm not. I was a government employee. If I was going to be cynical, I would have been there already. Yeah. Yeah.
Thank you for your time and comments and questions.
Thanks, Matt.
Thank you, Matt.
Thanks, Matt.
Well presented.
Any additional staff or commissioner comments?
I would just offer that it looks like the January 18th meeting will probably be canceled, as we don't have any items currently ready to go on to that agenda. And we're not quite sure about February yet as well, but we'll let you know. Continuing to kind of process development code amendments is the primary work item that we have going right now. And not, as far as we know, no, well, we have potentially some development applications coming through, but that probably wouldn't be until March or April. So in the meantime, it'll just be work sessions and at some point bringing these back for review at a public hearing. So we'll keep you advised on that. We'll let you know for sure on the 18th, but it sounds like that will be canceled. We're also working to put out an RFP to get a consultant for the urban growth boundary amendment. That's not been public yet, but we're working on it. It should be public by next week, and we'll give folks about 3 weeks or so to apply for it or to submit a proposal, and then we'll go through an interview process. Maybe we'll have, like I think in the past we've had, Jeff, I think you've participated in some of those interviews of prospective consultants. And then hopefully we'll have somebody on board by the end of March is kind of what I'm shooting for. But that's proceeding along. I think that's it for, do you guys have any? Emmy, do you have any announcements? Okay. So I think that's it for us.
Are you going to be here on the 1st? Or are you gone?
No, in February.
Okay. Can you run the meeting on the 1st if we have one?
The 1st of what?
February?
Absolutely.
Okay. I'm going to be gone.
It's on my calendar.
Any other additional comments, questions? Happy New Year, everybody.
Yep. Happy New Year.
Okay. Meeting adjourned.
Oh, I did want to I'm sorry. I just wanted to, I did have one more. Did I get it in?
Stop.
Let's go to the replay here. I think
where's the red?
Actually real
red, right?
Oh, the red.
Okay. I just wanted to plug that that we are organizing a community kind of open house on the 22nd from either 4 to 6 or 4:30 to 6:30. The council is doing something a little different this year for their council goals, is they're trying to get community input before they establish those. So once we get more formal information, I'll share it with you via email, but just wanted to plug that.
Wait, you say the 22nd, you're talking about January?
Yes.
4:30.
What's that?
I think it's 4:30. It's on my calendar.
You already have it on your calendar? Because we were talking about it this morning. It might have settled at 4:30 to 6:30, I think. So yeah, I think you're right.
Well, it might have come out in the
Stampede or the Roundup?
Yeah, that.
I got to stop calling it the Stampede. It's the Roundup. I don't think any government agency should be calling their newsletter the Stampede, right?
Runs right over you.
Scott, could we call out the new hire?
Sure. Yeah.
You?
Yeah, we've made a hire for a new position here at the city. It's a deputy recorder/ communications manager. Carrie Prosser, who was previously the city recorder, has moved up to an assistant city manager position. And so that created an opening. And Rebecca Green is the hire. Some of you may know her. I think she's lived around here for a little while. She was on the UFB board for she is on the UFB board, which is the forestry board currently. And so I think she starts on January 22nd. So that'll be a big help for the community in general, or for the city in general, and the community to expand some of our communication efforts. Whereas Carrie was doing quite a few jobs at once, this will be somebody that can devote more time to that. And I think it'll help get our message out more effectively. So thanks for plugging that. Okay, Jeff, you can.
Any other comments or questions? Going once, going twice. Sold. Thanks, guys.